From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
101.9, it's Kate Turkington, Travels with Kate, High FM. A very good afternoon to you. And we've had such a beautiful week of Johannesburg winter weather. You can't beat Johannesburg weather. Okay, Cape Town, you've got the mountains, you've got the vineyards, but my word, you don't have the best weather in the world that we have here in Johannesburg. I'm going to be talking to Ted Boerter later on, the author of the absolutely amazing Daisy DeMelko book, and he talks about Johannesburg as the kind of beating heart of South Africa, not always for the right reasons. So I'm going to talk to you today about Norway. I've visited Norway. I had a fantastic trip. I've only been there once. I have been to the rest of Scandinavia, but I was invited to go to Norway at a very good time in the year, in August, by the Hurtigruten Steamship Company. You can Google them, Hurtigruten. That line, that shipping line, has been plying the waters of northwestern Norway for decades. So think of a map of Norway. We're right on the left-hand side there on the northwestern coast. And it stops, the mail boat, the one I did, it stops at over 35 ports and small fishing villages on its very, I must tell you, very dramatic route from Bergen, which is where you board the ship, to the town of Kirkenes in the Arctic Circle and back again. It was originally a purely functional route. Now it's touted as the world's most beautiful voyage, and in fact, it's become one of Europe's chief tourist attractions. It draws thousands and thousands of visitors a year, but it's also a mail boat, so it stops, as I say, over 35 ports, and it doesn't wait for you. I went with a colleague, a journalist colleague, Sue Grant Marshall, who also reviews books. And my winter jackets, it was very cold, even though it was August, suddenly, I think the zip went. So we went off to this small fishing village on one of the stops to try and find Kate a new jacket. And indeed we did, and I still have it. But just as we were leaving the shop, we heard the whistle of the boat go, and we ran like mad to get back to the boat, and they were just drawing the gangplank up as we got there, and we arrived very, very breathless on deck. So it's not like a cruise ship in that, you know, you all queue up and you go on those excursions and there are far too many people. Saw them in Malta last year, 40, 60 people doing an excursion and one guide trying to talk to them. The Hurtigruten things aren't like that at all. Mail boat, you get on and off as you please, and you make sure you get back on time. And as I say, it goes all the way from Bergen up to the Arctic Circle. So have a look and think about that. Anywhere we travel today, given the state of the Rand, is going to cost a lot of money. But as one of my grandsons said to me last night, I think he said, YOLO, you've only got one life. YOLO, Granny. I said, you're saying it to the wrong person, Rex. I've taken opportunities and made opportunities all my life. So we'll take a short break, and then I'll tell you a lot more about Norway and the things that I saw and you would see if you go on one of these trips.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
Welcome back. I'm Kate Turkington. I'm telling you about Norway. Let me give you a bit of context. First of all, for quite a big country, it's only got 5.5 million people, which is not very much. I think I'm right in saying it's the second richest country per capita in Europe. Why? Because of the North Sea gas and oil, which they discovered, I don't know now, how many decades ago. So it's a very, very rich company. And by the way, you will see oil rigs, oil platforms. Do you know that they're higher than the Empire State Building, the top bit, but like icebergs, two-thirds of them are actually below the surface. And it was quite interesting when I went, and still I think with some of the older people, Norway, of course, in World War II was on the side of the Allies. It was on the side of Britain and America and her allies. And it was bombed extensively. And many, many freedom fighters fought against the Germans, and they were tortured and shot. So there's still some ill feeling lingering among older folk. Many of the towns that were burnt down during World War II have now been rebuilt. But, of course, this is Scandinavia with some of the best government looking after the people policies in the world. Unemployment, only 5%. Very, very generous policies. Mums get a year maternity leave. A year maternity leave. When I was at Vits, long time ago, having my last baby, I think I got 5 weeks. Anyway, in Norway, you get a year's maternity leave. Dads also get maternity leave. They get 15 weeks of non-transferable use-it-or-lose-it paid leave. The schools are free, not the universities. Very, very high standard of living. Amazing recycling. Every village and city has its own recycling rules. If you're working, you get 5 weeks of summer vacation, 1 week for Easter, 1 week for Christmas, as well as the public holidays. So that's pretty good going. Unfortunately, now there's an immigrant problem blooming. The country apparently has implemented all sorts of measures to facilitate integration, but they are having problems. But, and this is the but, so you've got all those good things, all those amazing good things, but there's no sun from the beginning of November to the end of February. It's Stygian gloom. No sun, and only 1.5 hours light at noon in the winter months. So think about it. You've got all your day, and you've only got 1.5 hours of light. So no wonder Norway has one of the highest alcoholism rates in the world. And as you sail along that northwest coast, you see these little houses painted rose pink. I mean, many of the villages are painted in lovely colours, but there's always one little wooden building which is painted a particular shade of rose pink. What are these? I call them the New King Houses, very irreverently, but it's where you go to recover from your seasonal depression. How do you recover from your seasonal depression? They give you doses of vitamin D. And I don't mean doses as in tablets or pills. They actually provide vitamin D sunlight, phony sunlight. So you've got all these good things, but those few months, dark, 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 no sunlight. So instead of going off to a bathhouse or going off somewhere to have a bit of relaxation, you go and get nuked, you go and get vitamin D'd in these little rose pink houses. So it's a very wild and beautiful coastline. Very fast-changing weather, vast distances, and, of course, it's famous for being the land of the northern lights, the midnight sun and the polar night, what I was talking about there. So what will you see? You'll see high mountains, you'll see glaciers, you'll see fjords, you'll see islands, you'll see rocky shores. And do you know how many islands there are along that northwest coast of Norway? 30,000 islands. And I likened it in my notebook. I wrote at the time. It's like, imagine a giant hand had picked up a handful of 3D jigsaw pieces and scattered them in a broken line from south to north. That's the coast of Norway. So many islands, skerries, pieces of land, rocky humps, all lying haphazardly in the sea. Would they fit together? Probably not. So, of course, there are loads of lighthouses, bridges galore, and tunnels connecting these islands. And one of my guides told me, he said, we build tunnels so that tourists can see what Norway looks like from the inside. And one of the tunnels I went through was 140 meters below the surface of the fjord. So off I went on, as I say, a big hurtigruten mailboat, 1,000 passengers. Some were like recreational passengers. Many were just there catching the mailboat from one little village to another. And as I said, you go all the way up from Bergen to the tiny town of Kirkenes, which is actually 5,000 kilometres north of the capital, Oslo. And Kirkenes, this tiny little town, is only a couple of kilometres from the Norwegian-Russian border. You know, Russia is very big, and it has borders with many, many countries. It's something to think about. Not sure I'd like to be living in Kirkenes. Well, I wouldn't because of the weather anyway. But this steamship service, it's quite amazing. It started in the late 1800s. And at that time, there were only 2 marine charts and only 28 lighthouses. So they went, that very first ship apparently, all it had was a compass and a clock. And it stopped at only 9 tiny towns. Can you imagine the late 1800s? Off they go with a compass and a clock. But then I thought to myself, remember the Vikings got to America from Norway over 1,000 years ago. And how did they do it? In their longboats. I actually read that you can see those amazing Viking longboats in the museum in Oslo, but I see at the moment it's closed for a refurb, so it's only going to be open in 2025. But there are lots of other places near Oslo where you can also see those longboats, which are remarkable. I mean, they had a sail. No cabins, nothing. The Vikings slept under their wooden seats, and in the day they sat on those wooden seats and rowed those boats. Just think, they got from Norway to America. Sure, they were tough men. Anyway, today lots of ships go up that coastline. They carry passengers and vehicles and cargo, and they go up and down that coast 3 or 4 times a week. And as I told you earlier, now the PR people have got onto it and are calling it the world's most beautiful sea voyage. Well, certainly it's one of the most beautiful sea voyages I've ever made. And I'll tell you where to go and how to go and when to go after the break.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
101.9 High FM. I'm Kate Turkington. You're travelling with Kate. And where are we at the moment? We're in Norway. And we're sailing up the west coast of Norway from Bergen in the south right the way up to Kirkenes in the north at the edge of the Arctic Circle. So when do you go? Well, obviously you've got to go in summer. You don't want to go when there's only an hour and a half daylight. So go in summer for the better weather and the quality of the light. I remember one night there was a very soft pink sunset. It was about 10 o'clock at night. So I was standing on the deck and there was a blazing, perfect half moon on the shining on the silvery sea. It was absolutely beautiful. Alternatively, if you want to see the winter aurora borealis, the northern lights, you've got to go in winter. And that's when, as you know, the sky puts on a natural firework display. I'm still a bit hazy about it happens, but apparently it's electrically charged solar particles high in energy enter the Earth's atmosphere at about 67 degrees north in the Arctic Circle. I got that. Thank you, ChatGPT, for explaining the Northern Lights to me. They're usually yellow-green, but can be green or reddish-violet. I've seen them. I was lucky enough to see them twice. Once on this voyage, when we saw them at the very end of the voyage, and once, I think I may have told you before, I was flying back from the States via a very unusual route over Japan. And the pilot suddenly said, don't all rush to the left-hand side of the plane. Please go 2, 3, 4 at a time because there are the Northern Lights. And I was luckily, Turkington luck, I was sitting by the window on the on the correct side of the plane and the Northern Lights were just blazing in the sky. And they just suddenly appear. They don't sort of trickle in. You know, you don't sit there and you see a bit and then you see a bit and a bit of it. It's whoosh. Here are the Northern Lights. Suddenly, any of you who've seen those know exactly what I mean. And why do you go? Well, obviously, to experience the world's most beautiful sea journey and to see all those little towns and fishing villages along the route. As I said to you, the ship stops 35 times. You can get off and on at will. And let me give you a very, very good tip. If you are a cruise person or if you go on cruises of any kind, never, never do the excursions that the ships offer. First of all, they're priced out of sight. They are far, far too expensive and there are far, far too many people and usually only one guide. It's awful. You're corralled around like a bunch of not very wild horses from one site to another. You can't hear the guide even if you've got a thing in your ear and the whole thing is not particularly pleasant. So here's a very good tip for any cruise. Let the excursion people go. Go off the ship, hire a taxi. Say to the taxi, I've got $100, I've got $200, whatever your budget is, and say, please take me to X attraction, Y attraction. That's the way to do it. That's in this case, in the Bergen Kirkenes, there are not many excursions offered, so you can pop on, off and on as you like. But certainly when I did a cruise to Iceland, I fell in with a geologist and his son, and every port we stopped, off we went to the dock. We hired a taxi, shared the cost and saw everything personally and usually with an amazing guide as well. And who goes on these Norwegian mail boat cruises? Well, as I said, my colleague Sue Grant Marshall was with me on this one. There were quite a few Germans. There was a delightful, sitting at our table was a rector from West Wittering in Sussex, and he and his wife were really something like out of a British sitcom, the vicar and his wife. So I told you why to go. Let me tell you some of the highlights. Anybody Norwegian listening, please forgive my pronunciation, because some of the Norwegian names, like the Icelandic names, I find very, very difficult to pronounce. So apologies in advance. Well, highlights, Geirangerfjord. It's a magnificent UNESCO World Heritage Site. And imagine, just think, there's tumbling waterfalls, there's rugged cliffs, there's majestic mountains, and they're all mirrored in the very, very, very still, deep water of the fjord. A few years ago, National Geographic described this fjord as the world's most untouched travel destination. And of course, what happens when somebody says this is the most untouched, beautiful spot in the world? Thousands of people immediately rush off to it. But even so, most beautiful, beautiful place. And a fjord, and thanks GPT for this, is a glaciated valley flooded by the sea to form a long, narrow, steep-walled inlet. So that's your fjords, and we saw lots of them. And places along the way, Trondheim, very interesting place, founded by Viking King Olaf in 997. You know, it's amazing. As I said, a bit later on, I'm going to be talking to Ted Boerter about Johannesburg. What are we, 120 years old? 997, this town was founded. I mean, it really is almost unbelievable. And the cathedral there, it's a huge cathedral, Trondheim Cathedral, huge Gothic cathedral, and that goes back to the 1100s. And like so many churches in Northern Europe, it's very austere and forbidding and gloomy. It does have beautiful, gorgeous rose windows. And King Olaf himself is actually buried here. And many kings were crowned here. So I suppose it's like the Norwegian equivalent of England's Westminster Abbey. And then my favourite fjord of all, Trolls Fjord. Trolls. Now, don't think trolling on the internet or whatever. Trolls are these mythical, mythical creatures, huge, huge giants. They sleep for 1,000 years, and then after their midday nap, they come out into the fjord. But they mustn't let sunlight get onto them, because if sunlight gets onto them, what happens? They're frozen. So you go into this Trolls Fjord, and these huge, massive rocks, all looking like crouched giants, frozen in time, frozen in stone. And I want to read you what I actually wrote in my notebook at the time. It's nearly midnight. Dark, ominous, oppressive mountains loom up in the dim light, which is like twilight. Charcoal, rugged shapes, imposing, dramatic grandeur, swirling mist and grey, wraith-like shreds of clouds, rocks and rock formations like frozen trolls, crouching, sitting, hunched up, petrified in stone. And a grey light breaks through the grey sky, and a deathly pallor cloaks the mountains and rocks, and reflections of the frozen trolls are perfectly still in the oily-looking water as we silently make our way along and through the fjord. No colours except greys, blacks, the occasional call of a lone bird. And what the captain of the ship did, or one of his hench people did, they played Grieg's Hall of a Mountain King as we went through this fjord. So it was a spectacular hour or so. And then you go further north to Tromsø, the northernmost Protestant church in the world, the northernmost Catholic cathedral in the world, and the northernmost brewery. I tried to find out if there was a synagogue there, but I can't get any information. Maybe somebody listening knows that. What is the northernmost synagogue in the world? Is it in Norway? In fact, I'd love to know. If you do find out, my email is kate@kateturkington.com. kate@kateturkington.com. I'd love to hear from you. And then, as you know, and I've often told you, I'm a bird watcher. So 71 degrees north, and this is where I'm really going to battle with the pronunciation, Hjärtsvallstapeln in the Arctic Ocean. It's one of the world's most exciting nature reserves. I mean, there are animals like whiskered seals, but it's birds you come here for. Puffins, kittiwakes, guillemots, cormorants, shags, Arctic skuas, northern gannets, a purple sandpiper, which actually wasn't very purple, just looked like an ordinary sandpiper, and 50 sea eagles all waiting to pounce on the baby puffins. And this, to me, is one of the miracles of nature. I think David Attenborough did talk about it in one of his programs. On the 14th of April, each year, between 3 p.m. and 8 p.m., regular as clockwork, millions and millions of puffins come back to this little island. Can you believe it? And one of the crew said to me, the sky is black for hours. It's black for hours as the puffins come back to the island. And they come back to their very own holes. Just like salmons go back to where they were spawned. Turtles come back to the beaches where they were hatched. So these puffins come back to the same holes, their little burrows, every summer. Can you believe it? On the 14th of April, even in a leap year, and millions of puffins come back. So there we are. That's Norway for you. It's a wonderful, wonderful voyage to do. And now I think there's not only the mail boat, which is the one I'd recommend, but there are all sorts. Hurtigruten does all sorts of other cruises up that coastline. So maybe you've never thought of Norway. So put Norway on your bucket list.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
101.9 High FM, Kate Turkington. Time to talk books. If you're looking for an enthralling, absolutely unputdownable, hate that word unputdownable, but I can't think of another one in this case, an unputdownable read, well, look no further than Ted Boerter's latest page-turner, Daisy DeMolka, Hiding Among Killers in the City of Gold. It's published by Jonathan Ball. It came onto my desk. I picked it up. I read it in one sitting. I did get up for a whiskey occasionally, but otherwise I just read it from start to finish. And you'll almost certainly have heard of it by now. Praise has been coming in from all quarters, including Dion Mayer, who writes, Boerter has created an instant classic. And I'd agree with that. Wow, what a roller coaster read. And on the line now, joining me, author of Daisy DeMolka, Ted Boerter. Now, how did the book come about, Ted?
Well, morning, Kate. Thank you very much for those words. I'm glad you enjoyed a whiskey between reading. I was researching Johannesburg, another story about the movie making in Johannesburg in the early 1900s, which is a really a forgotten story. And a lot of very colorful characters started popping out of the woodwork, you know, artists, journalists, politicians, criminals. And then, of course, Daisy DeMelka popped up on the scene. And as I started researching her more and more, I decided to bring her into the story of the movie maker to try and make a kind of a wider pastiche of Johannesburg of the time. And then all these other criminals also started coming into the story. And so it kind of got a life of its own. And I decided to make it a story about the criminals of those early days and how Daisy hid among them while she committed her evil, dastardly deeds.
So this is basically Johannesburg, 1914 to 1932. By the way, I love the photographs. I mean, I'm a sucker for old photographs anyway, but some of your old photographs, not only of her, but, you know, of Johannesburg, the marketplace at that time, they enrich the read as well. Now, you say that Johannesburg, God, sounds like now, one of the most turbulent and opulent times in a city that had become famous the world over for the impossible riches that lay in the gold-bearing reef under the 60-mile stretch of mining towns. Before we come to that cast of characters, can you paint a kind of word picture of what Johannesburg was like?
I think the thing that I found most astounding while I was doing the research was, as South Africans, we tend to kind of downplay a lot of the great things about South Africa. And I don't think I realized what an important city Johannesburg was, even at that time. And it happened very, very quickly. So from 1886, when gold was first discovered, it just exploded. And you had this influx of people and ideas and entertainment and charlatans and people trying to make their riches. And, you know, it made for this incredible kind of theater. And I think that was the most impressive thing for me, is it just happened so quickly. And it was much, much bigger than I ever thought it had been. You know, I imagined this kind of dusty, you know, big mining town, but like nothing on the scale that I found. And that's what really captivated me.
Well, we'll come back to Johannesburg itself in a while, but this amazing city, I love your analogy there of a theater, because this theater, this amazing city at that time, held a remarkable cast of characters. And I'm quoting again, a school teacher, a rodeo man, an escaped prisoner, a peddler, a young female student, a motorbike enthusiast, a prudish novelist, a witch doctor, a farmer's widow, a gun runner, an extremely talented lawyer, and a son who wanted too much from his mother. But before we come to the extremely talented lawyer and the needy son, tell us, just pick one of those other characters and tell us about them. I mean, there was everything from a Bonnie and Clyde kind of pair to, oh, ruffians and rascals and con men and women galore.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, that's an unfair question because they're all so colorful and they each have their own kind of, I don't know, allure. But I guess many would pick the Foster Gang as a highlight. But, you know, somebody who came up from nowhere and I just loved was this character, Andrew Gibson, because he wasn't a murderer like most of the others. He was a forger and a very proficient forger who seemed to love using fake Australian bonds, which he sold to people. And he was also a bogus surgeon, and he performed operations on people. And he apparently had the most incredible personality. People loved him. He was charming, and he kind of went in and out of jail, but he never, never stopped being a criminal. He just couldn't get away from this profession of his life. And you know, when he came out of the stories, I just thought, oh, he's just too, yeah, I just can't avoid this guy. And then he popped up again, went back to jail, and then he popped up again. And, you know, he kind of made a great thread through a lot of the stories because he kind of crossed paths with some of the other characters, and it kind of almost made it a fictional story.
Exactly.
Which was very, very helpful for me as the writer, because suddenly these threads that I'd never imagined suddenly came to be.
Well, that leads me actually to my next question. I was going to say to you, where does Daisy fit in to all of this? I mean, her story up to the time she was arrested.
Well, the thing about Daisy was, you know, she was living her life in the shadows of what was going on in Johannesburg. And I mean, people have said to me, and I've often thought, you know, how much was she affected by the crime that was going on around her? Because, you know, when the Foster gang was creating this hysteria in Johannesburg, she must have known about it. They were hiding out not very far from where she was living at the time in Turfontein. She moved then to Bertram's on the east side of Johannesburg, which was a haven for a lot of people like Herman Charles Bosman and Andrew Gibson and the Foster gang when they were younger. And I often wondered whether she kind of was a bit influenced by this. She hid out doing her, like, poisoning people because she knew there was no attention being put on people like her. It was the more obvious criminals. And she got away with it for a long time.
And
so, I mean, she began.
How did she get away with it, Ted?
Well, I mean, now you're asking me to play detective for that era. But, I mean, you know, poison is and always has been a very chosen form of, at least until the early 1900s, it was a very chosen form of killing people because it was easy to get away with. You had to connect the poison to the person. And, you know, poison was very easily discarded. So unless you've got somebody coming forward saying, I sold poison to that person, or you catch them in the act or with the poison, you know, it was very easy for Daisy to get away with it. So like any poisoner, the connection was hard to make. And so she could masquerade her poisonings as illness of her children or illness of her husband's until finally the connection was made between her and the poison, and that was her downfall.
And it's quite interesting because she was clever, because every time one of the families she'd poisoned was sick, was ill, she would immediately call in doctors and family and played the part of the worried mother, the distraught mother, extremely well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, as her lawyer pointed out in his autobiography, and he was a brilliant, brilliant man, and he said that he had this very specific modus operandi. You know, it was to always have another illness in the background, which the doctors could say, well, it was kidneys, or it was liver, or it was heart, or it was lead poisoning. And then she called in a lot of doctors, and she called in a lot of neighbors and friends. And so there would be all this conflicting information going around about, I saw this and I saw that. And in her trial, it could be used to kind of throw shade on all the witnesses that came forward.
And go back to that event that finally led to her arrest.
Should we give away the surprise?
No.
Don't give away the whole thing. There was a chemist involved, and there was a photograph involved, and a connection was made that she might have killed somebody. So, and that was what kind of led to the court case in the end.
What amazed me, Ted, was the impact of the trial. Not only the local impact, but it became a global sensation. I mean, one of your photos, I love it, is of people sitting on the steps of the Supreme Court during the month-long trial, and they were sort of queuing for seats inside for the trial, and if they got them, often selling them. So it had a worldwide impact. It was actually a worldwide sensation. The English newspapers were there. The American press was there. Why do you think?
I think it was kind of a perfect storm. You know, it was not only the person who was involved, she was a mother, she was a wife who had had multiple husbands. Women found this very intriguing. They hated her, and yet they were jealous of her. She was a strong character. She, like, sat up in court, and she was very attentive. She wasn't sticking her tail between her legs. She wasn't any wilting daisy. I mean, she was out there in full bloom, as I could say. And it also, I think, had to do with Poison and the fact of its entertainment value. Yeah. I mean, trials were theater for people. I mean, I came across that reference often when I was doing research, saying that, you know, people turned up for court cases by the hundreds. And this was for all the cases that I talk about in the book of the different criminals. And, you know, her lawyer says once again that people loved the fact that trials were the real thing. There wasn't there was no artifice. It was people were fainting, jumping on tables, screaming, crying. And of course, in the entertainment world, and Johannesburg was a real center of entertainment, movies were changing. I mean, it was the change in those years from silent movies to talkie movies, you know, and they were very, very popular in Johannesburg. And so I don't think one can kind of, underscore how much entertainment played a role in all of this. And of course, the fact that her name was Daisy. I mean, who could have wished for a better name for somebody accused of lots of poisonings with the name Daisy?
It's I'm just thinking while you were talking about how trials are entertainment, you think of everything today, from the John Grisham novels to TV series. How often is a trial the very, very center of the proceedings? And it's like you say, it's the real thing. It's happening. You can't fake it at the time. Now while you were talking about movies, there was that whole coincident. Was it a coincident? You wrote about the brand new super cinema that was actually opening in Johannesburg during Daisy's trial. I mean, not only was it the biggest in Africa, 3,000 seats metro, but it was bigger than most of the great movie houses of London and New York. And here it was opening in Johannesburg during Daisy's trial. And didn't the head of the studios come out for the opening?
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the coincidences that I came across while I was doing the movie book, which I'm still writing. And it was, for me, it was just this wonderful, wonderful crossing of the two stories, where these people are coming back. They're coming back from the trial, and they're going in front of this theater where hordes of people are gathered outside for the opening. And of course, the irony was they're showing Buster Keaton's The Passionate Plumber, which, considering Daisy's husbands were all plumbers, it was very, very strange. I don't think they'd actually planned it that way, but who knows, maybe they did. And then, of course, the next week, the head of MGM in Hollywood came out to officially open the Metro.
I mean, that's like a PR company's mecca, if you like. the passionate plumber and plumbers Daisy had been poisoning. Now, two famous writers take part in this drama. First of all, Herman Charles Bosman, Scout Lawrence creator. Just tell us about his part in this play, this drama.
Well, you know, he came up firstly because he had murdered his stepbrother in 1926 and was, you know, condemned to death, although that was commuted shortly afterwards. But of course, that week that he spent on death row became then Cold Stone Jug many years later. And he started on his kind of writing career while he was in jail, and he wrote some poems. And when he came out early, he was out after about 4 years, and he landed up in this Johannesburg where Daisy was now onto her, almost onto her third husband, and she was about to kill her son. And then he became this, the town crier for Daisy and wanting to get her off the hook. And he saw her as this, his poster girl for, ending capital punishment, because he didn't want her to see her go to the gallows. He was very anti-capital punishment. So he was a great person to have in the story, and he doesn't come off particularly well. I think people think more, and I always thought more of his writing, his creative writing, which I love. But you know, when you get to read more about a writer, you discover, you know, or any artist who's a genius, that they're probably not particularly nice.
And have free to play very often.
Yeah, and he was quite unscrupulous in the way he covered or didn't cover the trial and yet wrote about it. And, you know, he had this very romantic view of one of the other characters in the book who dies, Dorothea Croft, who is also a woman who murdered her lover. And he had this very romantic vision of her, you know, trailing her long hair as she walked to the gallows. And this beautiful, you know, reminded him of the Zulu queen in a movie he'd seen. So it was kind of, he had this very idealized version of the whole thing.
Very romanticized. Many moons ago, I won't tell you now because it's a long story, but I actually read his stories written in pencil. I was teaching a short course on African literature at the University of Texas in Austin, and much to my surprise, discovered they have the best collection of African literature in the world. That's another story. But there were his notebooks written in lead pencil, obviously by guttering lamplight. It was quite everybody knows they're there now, but I certainly didn't know. It was a very exciting moment. And the other writer, Gertrude Millen, who was fated when she first started writing and had been wrote bestsellers.
For sure. I mean, it's amazing, and maybe not amazing, that, you know, she kind of blotted her copybook because of some of the racial things that she wrote. I mean, she brought a completely different side of the story to Daisy, because she was the one who did go to court. She was this famous novelist who, Eleanor Roosevelt fated her at her house in New York, and she was a friend of Theodore Dreiser, and she wrote to Mahatma Gandhi, and she was a big name, and she had pulled herself up from a life very much like Daisy's as a youngster. I mean, she had grown up in Kimberley on the banks of the Orange River, and, you know, but she had made something of herself. She'd married a lawyer. She had become this novelist, and, you know, she decided that she wanted to take a look at what was going on in Daisy's case. And she was a prude. She was a very, very solid prude, albeit she was a feminist as well. And so she, unlike Bosman, who didn't attend the court case but wrote about it, Sarah Gertrude Millen did attend the court case and then wrote a novel based on Daisy's case afterwards. So it was good to juxtapose these two views of the writers in the court.
And let's come to the very charismatic defense lawyer, Harry Morris. You mentioned the charismatic defense lawyer early on, but his name was Harry Morris, and he was really something, wasn't he?
No, fantastic. I mean, fantastic. I mean, I mentioned Andrew Gibson earlier,
yes,
as my favorite character, but Harry Morris also was probably stood out as my favorite character, and ironically was Andrew Gibson's lawyer. So way before Harry got Daisy DeMalca as his client, he had Andrew Gibson every time he came out of jail and he went on to another crime. Harry was there to defend him, because Harry, even though he was this incredible lawyer and barrister, he liked taking on cases which were very, very difficult and almost certain to fail. And often he got his client off. So he was just brilliant. And I mean, talk about theatrical. He took it up a notch, and he was very theatrical in court.
Yes. suggest you write how he'd have these pregnant pauses, or he'd touch his robe, or whatever. I mean, now lawyers have become performers, haven't they? But he was a very early charismatic one, which all added to the drama of the trial, of course. Now, though, you don't want to talk about the very final act of this gripping drama, but let's come back to Daisy herself. I mean, you've got a photo of her, a couple of photos, in fact. She says herself she didn't like her photos. Nobody likes photos of themselves. But she wasn't an attractive, beautiful woman. She looks a very sort of dumpy, plain, you know, not the sort of woman to have got three husbands and she didn't look the part, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Well, I guess, you know, they didn't talk about things like sex in those days, but I guess she's a highly sexed woman. And, you know, one can't tell from a picture what kind of sexual allure she gave off to men, but clearly she did. I mean, she had five children in quick succession with the first husband. And I think that probably played a really big role in the men that she got. But at the same time, she clearly didn't like men because all her victims were male, from her children to her fiancé to her husbands to everyone else that she is suspected of killing.
Wasn't it a case of follow the money? Didn't she do it for the insurance?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, obviously, she only got the insurance from her son. And I mean, yeah. I think it's clear that she killed her son more because he was becoming a problem than for the small amount of insurance she got off of him. From her husbands, she got their money, their will, the money in their wills and their estates, and she got property from them. So I think the money was clearly an object, but then one comes to her children. I mean, they were all under the age of five. That was not, you know, that wasn't a, there was
money
no,
wasn't the motive. Yeah.
So, I mean, all of those things she took to her grave, because of course she never accepted guilt for any of the things she did, even, you know, to the day she was executed.
And I love your final words. This is, I'm talking to Ted Butcher, the author of this amazing book, I loved it, Daisy DeMelka, Hiding Among Killers in the City of Gold. It's published by Jonathan Ball. And Ted's final words, I do, because I really relate to these. You say, of course, Johannesburg, a city that still seems to be as revered and reviled as it has always been, played no small role in writing this book. Somehow, despite everything, it charms and inveigles its way into your core. It remains utterly fascinating. Ted, thanks so much. Thanks so much. I so, so enjoyed the book and look forward to your next one.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Well, that's all for this week. We've been to Norway, we've talked about the Northern Lights, we've talked about puffins, and we had that fascinating conversation with Ted Butcher about his fascinating book about Daisy DeMelka. So, until next week, lots of love, lots of life, travel safely, take care of yourself, and take care of others too.